Drive-by cinema. Three nachos and a foaming thermos of fun.
Hello, bonjour, guten tag. This is Drive-by cinema. It's season 4, episode 37, as far as our best experts can determine. With me is one of those experts, my co-host, Paul.
Thank you ever so much, Richard, brother co-host. Wow, yeah, gosh, allez-y, let's go. Do you remember when we were children? I don't want to go into paces, weren't they, green sweets kind of stuff, but do you remember on the playground there was that horse you could rock backwards and forwards and six people could sit on it?
What, with a very powerful spring?
It's like a giant rocking spring, and it could actually go over the top. Your swing could never go over the top. This horse, if you sprung it far enough, would go over the top. Like a looping the loop kind of thing.
Oh, but it stayed upright because it was upright, yeah. On... Yeah,
two, I know what you mean. It was on two sort of elliptical kind of paths on two hinges. I can't express it.
Yeah, it was like a medieval battering ram, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And if you face slammed it, you were going to get hurt, weren't you? Okay, people often did.
Lethal, I'm sure.
And we jumped on and jumped off of that. I don't want to go on that track of, wasn't it great when we were allowed to play in the dirt kind of stuff? But didn't we used to say, Ali, Ali, Asta? Faster, faster, Ali, Ali, Asta. Or is that just a locality?
That's a thing, yes. I feel like
Ali, Ali means
somewhere...
go, go, doesn't it?
Does it? Does it? I don't know.
Well, it's French for go, isn't it?
Well, it sounds like the kind of thing they did in public schools 100 years ago, not
and then the poor inherited it kind of thing.
maybe so.
Like football kits, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, so it's just a thing, because there's something French coming up today, isn't there?
What French coming up today? Oh, the film.
The movie, yeah.
Yes, okay. Paul, before we get onto that, we've got some admin to do as usual.
Oh, Christ. What's Charlie discovered this time?
This time it's listener Pete. Hello,
Pete. Thank you, listener. Thank you for your delicious attention to detail. What have we done wrong, Richard?
Well, first of all, Pete made a mistake. Oh. He tried to correct us by saying that the DeLorean was aluminium skinned, or aluminum skinned, as they say in the US. Of course, it's stainless steel. Stainless steel.
Yeah, better than my guess, Pete. I was going to say titanium, but
gosh, he did own up to that straight away. He'd already figured it out. So in the course of the conversation.
Did he bow as he omitted it in a courtly kind of medieval gesture?
I'm sure he did.
Waving a handkerchief, kind of thing.
The
thank you, Your Grace, I now retreat.
When we were talking about Ian McKellen's research institute somewhere in Oxford. We were talking... Actually, it was about...
What spacecraft was it when this happened? What are you talking about, Richard? We talked about Ian McKellen's research institute. Oh, in the movie. Oh, within
Infinitum,
the context.
Yes.
Within the context of the movie. Okay with you, yeah.
But actually, we diverged, didn't we, and talked about the three-body problem.
You
and
did.
I'd quickly described how they'd anglicised it or westernised it by making everyone be in Oxford. And I described that they had a particle accelerator that Oxford University had, which is not true, but there is some kind of physics research installation Oxford has that I think is called the Diamond Light Installation or Institute.
I remember when I had, I'll let you come back to it. I remember when, but I'll forget this if I don't say it right now. I remember when I had a young ambition to become some sort of theoretical physicist. And I went for a university interview, either University of Nottingham or University of Birmingham. And they did the whole interview thing and said, well, these are the kind of grades you need. And they kind of told you back in the day during the interview if they wanted you or not kind of stuff. And then they took us on a tour of the department. And there was some sort of little mini 25-meter long accelerator in there. He asked us, why do you think it's vertical?
Right.
And nobody knew. And he said, okay. I'll tell you why. It's so that they come down faster on the way down.
Uh-huh.
And everybody nodded sagely. And he said, I don't want any of you to come and study here ever.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And to this day, I don't know why it was built vertically.
Well, it takes less space, doesn't it?
I just interrupted you horribly. You were talking about the research institute that exists in Oxford that actually does have an accelerator.
Yeah, but a small one, I think. Well, I don't know whether it's an accelerator, even. Oh. Diamond Light? I don't know what that is. I haven't troubled myself to find out, in all honesty. What I have been doing is finishing the much, much longer Chinese adaptation of Three Body Problem, which is just called, by the way, Three Body, if you're looking for it.
I'm writing this down.
as I mentioned, is available on Amazon Prime.
Free?
Mostly free. I said it last time, but you can watch lots of the episodes, but then you suddenly come up to one that's behind a paywall and it asks you to buy a bunch of episodes.
That's clever.
I went looking for why. I found someone on an Amazon forum who I think was from Amazon Prime, and they said, hey, we don't set the prices. That's Tencent, who are the Chinese producers. They put the prices on. So I don't know what they're doing there. Here's the sad fact. I think you can probably see there's 30 episodes in the Chinese series. The Tencent series, Three Body, only covers the first book, whereas the Netflix adaptation covers the first sort of 1.5 books.
Whoa, like they've done a David Lynch there.
The Netflix one is done in 8 episodes. The Tencent one is done in 30 episodes.
There's no movie to watch here.
Just no movie, no.
There's so what you're saying is they do one book in 30 episodes. That's a progress rate of about 3% an episode. Whereas the Netflix, they do 1.5 books in 8 episodes. That's a progress rate of about 20% an episode.
Take what you will from that, but I don't feel that I missed anything from watching the Netflix version versus the Tencent version. It's just a very languid pace.
Oh, right.
And so I was quite happy to watch through the Chinese version, sometimes 3, 4, or even 5 episodes I had to skip because I wasn't going to pay for them, and then just pick it up afterwards and know precisely what I'd missed, in all honesty. So it's quite interesting.
So what you're saying is the Chinese version is, as the original soap opera on radio was conceived, just there to fill airtime, eyeball time, and sell adverts. Yeah.
Look, I'm sure it's a big and prestigious production for the Chinese audience. And the Chinese cast, as far as I can tell, and I don't know them, but they're probably stars, and they're all pretty good, I think. They're good actors.
Okay. Okay. Oh, I've got to check them out, see if I recognise any.
What's funny, though, is whenever there's a Western character... And bear in mind, this story does escalate beyond the Chinese scientists to a global catastrophe. So you do end up with the Pentagon or whatever the equivalent is and all generals and stuff from different nations. Whenever there is a Western character involved, it seems like they may have had a bit of a casting problem. They didn't seem to cast their net much further than, say, whatever Western characters were available in China at the time. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, white monkeys. Yeah, absolutely.
So they all have this quality of kind of amateur dramatic society doing their level best for Chinese TV.
Many a white person's career in sales, marketing, and advertising in China started drunken in a bar when somebody said, oh, would you mind being my poster child for whatever? I mean, I was the poster child for Makateur, or I don't know how you pronounce it in English, Makateur DVDs. Yeah.
Makateur DVDs.
Yes.
What is a Makateur DVD?
Well, we went to meet the guy. Well, it's just the name of the company, Makateur. Okay. I'm not sure. TCL, you know TCL, the people that make TVs?
No.
No, it's a spin-off. It was one of this, like, C something O's spun off his own little company called Makateur. Not so little. I mean, he was very well connected and got big bank loans from various provincial banks. But they produced DVDs, and I think they were the first people to produce them, because we went round to the inventor's house, who was just such a stereotypical kind of genius. And it's well known the Chinese invented DVDs, didn't they? As opposed to the LD system. And he was very excited. Yeah, so they recorded me over about 4 or 5 hours, pretending to be the inventor, whilst the actual Chinese inventor was there telling me what to say. And I had to draw on a whiteboard sort of my discovery of how to make DVDs work. And this was all before there was like a lot of aircon in the place. I think it was 96. I just chanced upon this. Oh, 97 was it? I can't remember. 97, I think. I had this sort of burgundy satin shirt in it from Next that I brought over with me. And it was just, I had these huge sweat marks in my armpits. It was just revolting. But then they did the photo shoot as well. So that was the video promotion. My face started appearing around the city next to David Beckham, who was selling Baleno shirts. I don't think he ever got paid to sell Baleno shirts, but there he was, photoshopped into Baleno shirts. There we go.
And they told you that the Chinese invented the DVD, did they, Paul, whilst you were there?
I believe them. I mean, I had no access to the internet at the time, Richard, so there's no way of checking it.
Okay, well, for future reference, I think you'll find it was the Japanese.
No, the LD. The LD. The LD was the Japanese, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know about the LD.
Pete can correct us.
The DVD was the Japanese, yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. Obviously, I'm looking at my Western internet here.
Anyway,
knows?
So, well, the point is, I don't really care because I got paid handsomely. And they paid me, because the electronics company, they paid me with some subwoofers, a home electronic system, like an amplifier, back when people used to buy amplifiers, a TV and that kind of thing. And like a one-off payment of, I don't know, £1,000 or £2,000 kind of thing. And it really opened my eyes that you could become a very successful white monkey. I just appear airbrushed in various guises promoting things.
That's strange though. Why did they think you would need a subwoofer? Because you don't have a submarine, do you? No. I presume it's like a guard dog for submarines. is that right?
It is, yeah, dogfish, yeah.
The question is, when they gave you a script, were you to read it in Chinese or in English?
In English.
And so did they give you
I certainly earned my keep because I gave them a valid, I adapted it to make it relatively harmonious and natural. But with the end, we had to say some things in Chinese, just a few little phrases, because it was going to be a home audience advert kind of thing.
Well, it's that step that our amateur dramatics players, White Monkeys in the Three Body series, didn't take. Well, they didn't go to anyone and say, look, some of the English in this script is a little bit clunky and weird. No, they just read it out and tried to make it sound as natural as possible.
So that opened my eyes to the fact you could get into Chinese media and get into Chinese, in particular, advertising and visual media advertising. And then, of course, once I knew this, I was listening to other people out there. Several people would go down to, like, the southwest of China and come back saying, hey, I was just in a movie kind of thing. And they cast me as like the lead foreign baddie kind of thing. And they get 20 minutes screen time and that kind of stuff and have to deliver these really fluffy lines. And they never acted in their lives at all, ever.
Yes, that explains
a lot.
About the Three Body series. It's actually a very entertaining thing to look for the white actors coming up in.
Actors, yeah, but they're not actors, are they? But there we go. So nothing's changed in 30 years, what you're telling me.
But I wanted to highlight a major difference that I noted between the two adaptations. Now, again, I haven't read the book, so I don't know what is more accurate. I do know that in the English translation, the original author kind of made changes because he sort of self-censored. In the Netflix adaptation and the English translation, it starts with a lot of revolutionary period stuff, Maoist revolution, Great Leap Forward stuff, where our lead character becomes very disillusioned because of the authoritarianism she's experiencing. Ultimately, that causes her to reach out to the aliens and say, hey, come and invade us because we've fucked it up here. Which is a very kind of collectivist idea, actually, if you think about it. Say, people can do better, but we're not those people kind of thing, isn't it?
She wrote a self-criticism to the stars, didn't she?
Effectively, yes. Mm. Yeah.
Well done.
In the Chinese original, the author had moved that section out of the front of the novel. I don't know whether it's the case that the censors only read the first couple of chapters and then get bored and then pass it away.
That is the case, I think, yeah.
So it must have felt safer to put it out of the way in that sense. But that's not the difference that I'm talking about. And the Chinese series does have those sequences, and it doesn't sugarcoat the Maoist revolutionary period, it seems. Obviously, it depicts the same kind of story.
I mean, interestingly, all the way from Deng Xiaoping to the two successors who are essentially his protégés. Of course, it was a done thing to condemn the Maoist.
Yes.
It's only really in the last 8 years since the new arrival on the throne.
Winning the poo, yeah.
So, well, I didn't say that. I want to go back there at some point and get the money out of my bank account. So it's only since then that Maoism has come slightly back into fashion, kind of thing. Street brigades and people kind of paying attention to how people behave in the community, that kind of stuff. Those kind of communalist ideas that privacy itself is somehow a little bit sinister.
So I want to explain the big difference that was very apparent to me. To do so, I just have to explain the big set piece that ends the Chinese series and that comes at a critical point in the Netflix series, but it does carry on after it quite a bit, which is that there's a group of humans who have communicated with the aliens or are kind of inviting them. And in this sense, they are depicted, I suppose, as the bad guys, because they're inviting a hostile alien force to come to Earth, right? They wind up on a boat with a big satellite dish that they use to communicate in space with. And it's like it's a converted oil tanker. It's a big ship.
So I'm laughing because I'm thinking of Saturday Night Live and Saturday Night Live and the lady who gets abducted with her itchy cooch kind of thing.
Now, the good guys need to get information off this ship. So they can't simply bomb it, blow it up, or send a cruise missile. They need to apprehend, if you like, the ship. and neutralise everyone on it, because there are soldiers and stuff they expect that this movement has recruited. Fortunately, they have this nanotechnology expert who's providing them with these nanowires that are apparently capable of slicing through a cargo ship or a
tanker.
Yeah. It's quite a cool scene. It's going through the Panama Canal, you see. And what they do is they get ahead of it and they erect these nanowires in front of the ship. And they're invisible because they're so thin.
What are they? But Mr. Fullerene chews with embedded diamond bonds or what?
Effectively, yeah, exactly.
Something
so
like
the idea is they're so strong, they won't break, and the ship will just plow into them, and it will slice the ship.
Wow.
It's effectively like one of those things you slice a boiled egg with.
Yes.
But they're going to do that with a ship, sort of horizontally. So the wires are horizontal, and it's going to slice the ship like layers of a cake.
Wow, like cheese wire.
Exactly, exactly. I think the idea, certainly in the Netflix version, is that the nano guy or girl, they're going to have a crisis of conscience when they realise how many people on the ship get sliced into several pieces. Right?
It's the old trolley problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Manhattan Project, isn't it? Same problem. Now, in the Netflix version, the good guys team, you know, erect all this stuff, use the tech, slice the ship, and the nano woman gets very upset. And she realises that the ship was full of families and children that were part of this human group.
Collateral loss is acceptable.
And they go quite a long way in the Netflix adaptation to show that there are kids and that they're just about to die. Although I don't think they show any sliced up kids.
Oh.
There's a very artistic bit where they show the little school classroom where the kids were. And they've got one of those things on the wall. When you fold up a piece of paper and you tear it so it looks like a little person holding hands, and you get a
paper chain.
Yeah, you unfold it and you get a paper chain of little people holding hands. You see that being sliced through so the bottom falls off each person all the down the paper chain as it's going through the classroom.
Oh.
You know that innocents have died in the Netflix version. Okay, so here's what the Chinese version does. Now, bear in mind, it takes place over two or three episodes. It's a bit slow.
Plenty of time for ad breaks.
In the Chinese version, in the run-up to the ship coming into the Panama Canal and putting the wires up, the nano-expert guy goes to the general, who is played by one of these avuncular amateur dramatics types.
Slightly ruddy-faced. Does he look slightly ruddy-faced, like he might have an alcohol problem?
And he explains to him, don't worry about the people on the ship. They're all the baddest of the bad guys. And he explains how they're all terrorists and pirates. He even goes so far as to point out that one of them, a guy who I think is called Enzo, was a terrorist that he took down. But when he was released from incarceration, he found his family and killed his family. And now he's on that ship with all these other bad hombres. And it cuts to people on the ship being like pirates, effectively, where, you know, they're stringing people up. But on the yardarm and threatening to throw the cabin boy overboard kind of thing. So they're really painted pantomime style. And of course, all of the actors are not Chinese that are on the ship. So they're all hilarious. They're all eating the scenery and overacting terribly. But you know that they are bad guys. I just thought it was really interesting that they bend over backwards in the Chinese thing to A, not kill any innocent kids, and B, actually not kill anyone innocent at all. They're all painted as despicable human beings. So there we go. Weird.
There's moral
squeamish
clarity for
perhaps.
You. Manufactured moral clarity. Okay.
Speaking of cultural differences, Paul, should we discuss this week's film?
After.
Who knows what kind of music this could be? Paul, did you listen to last week's music?
I didn't know. Should I have done?
Yeah, it's got lyrics and everything.
I'll listen as soon as I can. Here it comes.
Here we go. Last week, Paul, I think I described this film as French Scandi Noir.
French, definitely. I don't know if it's Scandi Noir.
No, it's a procedural, I would say. I'm not even sure about the drama. But it was award-winning, right? It won a Palme d'Or.
Palme d'Or, yeah. And the Queer Palme, or competed for the Queer Palme.
Or at least a dog did. Or did the dog win the Oscar? I don't know.
No, it won the Palme d'Or, and it won the Palme Dog, and it competed for the Queer Palme.
Palme Dog. Okay.
He's a very, very photogenic dog, he or she. The actual actress dog, actor dog, with like two different
Messi,
coloured eyes.
I think he's called Messi the dog.
Messi the dog, but he plays here
Snoop.
Snoop the dog, yeah.
I wanted to ask actually about giving canine actors the character name. That seems unnecessary and potentially difficult to me. But there we go. I don't know what the normal practice is. Or maybe it's useful. Maybe dogs are very method acting kind of thing.
But the name Snoop, everything, actually, Snoopy stayed fashionable in France for a much longer time than he did in his home country, didn't he?
Did he?
Ah. Yeah, yeah. Like, French teenagers were into Snoopy for a long time.
What's it called, Paul? We haven't even said the name yet.
Oh, this is Anatomy of a Fall from 2023.
We've said that it's a courtroom drama or procedural.
Yeah.
There's obviously going to be a crime. We have to explain what happens. We've got a family living somewhere in the High Alps. This is what made me think it was Scandi, right? It's just mountains and snow and stuff.
But it's Switzerland. But it's Grenoble.
They're in the French Alps.
Oh, that is France, isn't it? Yeah.
I think Grenoble is France, yeah.
It is, yeah. Sorry. The French Alps, but near Switzerland, probably, presumably.
Presumably, must be, right? On the French side of the Alps, yeah.
In a chalet.
In a chalet, yes. Which means a wooden house, as far as I can tell. Or is it more complicated?
Big, yeah, it's a big wooden shed, isn't it, really? The husband is entertaining to undertake repairs, or renovations, shall we say, to the chalet. It does seem rather drafty up there in the attic. Is that what chalets are like?
It's freezing cold, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no wonder they have to do renovations quickly, because it would freeze the entire house, I think, with those drafts.
Especially up there where they are, yeah. He is a lecturer and a writer, an aspiring writer.
Yeah.
And he's married to a more successful writer called Sandra.
Sandra.
He's called Samuel. She's Sandra. Called Sandra. Yeah. They've got a son called Daniel, who I'm ashamed to say, I think we must have been half an hour into the movie before I realised is blind, in fact.
Ah, yeah, well, yeah, I mean, fair play to you, because it's snowy. You're probably going to wear sunglasses anyway to go for a walk. In the snow, aren't you?
True, true. And he conducts himself very ably, doesn't he? You
know? He's not entirely blind, though, is he?
Well, very few people are.
Oh.
The colloquialism blind usually means
visually
some
impaired.
Impairment. Yeah, visually impairment, doesn't it? Which is strange, because later they do explain that he suffered that injury, that his blindness was caused when he was about 4 years old, when he got hit crossing the road by a motorcycle or a moped.
Due to the inattentions of his father.
That's true and important. But they said that it had severed his optic nerve. Yeah. And you would think if that had happened
total blindness.
In Norway, then it would result in total blindness. Yeah, so it must have just damaged his optic nerve.
Damaged his optic nerve, yeah. These French translators, not very good. So you're right, the husband had been a lecturer, had quit lecturing, but he's gone back part-time. He was a lecturer in London. He's gone back to lecture because he's a bit skint, isn't he? In fact, it seems that they're in debt as a family because they've taken on this rather gigantic renovation project in the Alps.
The fourth member of the family is the dog we've already mentioned, Snoop. Called Snoop.
Yeah. Who's
in fact, the dog, I think, is the first. I think he's the first member of the family we see because he follows a ball down the stairs, doesn't he?
He does. He's either some sort of collie, isn't he? Border collie or Shetland collie or Australian collie, I don't know.
He is. And far and away, the most likable member of the family.
Indeed, yeah.
The movie starts actually with Sandra being interviewed by someone who I think we learn later is a student, possibly to do with an interest in literature. She's called Zoe, and she is recording Sandra and trying to get her to answer questions about her work. Sandra's not really interested in that, it would seem. She's more interested in chatting, because I don't think they get many visitors up there, because they're in quite a high alpine valley, aren't they?
Yeah, so Sandra comes across as quite precious and quite highly strung, and a little bit kind of, I don't know, unbalanced.
Oh,
and it's not easy to conduct an interview. Well, it comes across to me. It comes across to me as such. And it's not easy anyway to conduct an interview, because the husband's upstairs banging away with his plasterer's music on, or his plumber's music on, which is a steel drum version, If You Can't Get a Dollar Out of Me by, who is it? I don't know.
P.I.M.P., isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, which is later described as highly misogynistic. I'm not sure it is highly misogynistic.
Well, it's not without the lyrics, which presumably talking about gangster hoes and stuff, aren't they?
Potentially, yeah. I don't think it does, though.
It's really annoying and played at an extremely high volume.
So we sense some sort of marital...
That is true.
...fragmentation here, some sort of marital disharmony. To the extent that the interview is cut short, she says, look, go back, we'll do it in Strasbourg or we'll do it in Geneva next time, kind of thing.
Yes, she does say
that. She cuts the interview short, doesn't she?
So Zoe leaves. quite angrily, I think. She's probably wasted a bit of her time. She doesn't close the door, I noticed. Although that could be because the cameraman was following her. And as she's leaving, Daniel is also leaving the house with Snoop to take him for a walk. We follow Daniel as he meanders through
the... boy stuff, doesn't he? Does his boy stuff. I don't mean a wee against the tree. I mean, he just plays around with stuff, doesn't he? He goes exploring.
He plays fetch with Snoop.
That's right.
There's a love-hate relationship with dogs, especially when they're playing fetch, because they're kind of stupid, aren't they? You know when you go to throw it, but you don't throw it, and the dog is fooled every time? Every time.
Oh, I don't know if they are always fooled.
Oh, you think they're play-acting?
Try it with a border collie. They're not fooled.
Okay.
Different dogs have different intelligences, Richard.
You're anthropomorphizing them, Paul.
Don't know if I am, actually. I mean, they're obviously capable of higher intelligence.
What, like answering the phone and preparing a light meal, or... what do you mean?
Well, I mean, when it comes to dog intelligence, are some dogs dumb or they're just lazy? That's the first thing. So there is a lot of debate here.
Right, okay.
But, I mean, dogs have been shown to understand at least hundreds of words. You're going to say it's all about the tone. I know what you're about to say.
I think it's fair to say that Messi, the actor, is pretty smart.
He is. I loved him. I actually love this dog actor. I would take him home.
But I just want to remark that for me, when I'm playing fetch with some dogs, there's an element of me like torturing them in a way, in the nicest possible way. I'm not trying to be cruel to them, but I kind of hate them for how dumb they are.
Let's slow down. The Grand National was this weekend, yeah? Okay. Because of the deaths last year, they brought in no national anthem before the start, so of course they have quiet, a kind of graded start with only 34 riders kind of thing. And
it's just cruel to ride dogs that distance, though, isn't it?
Shorter distance to the first fence. Weird idea. Apparently that makes it safer. I don't quite see how, but nobody died this year. But we ride these horses knowing full well there's a likelihood that they will die in the Grand National, and that's cruelty. I'm not justifying this one, but there was a woman that kicked a horse, her own horse, when it was misbehaving, do you remember? And she was pilloried on social media. If we compare these two things, not only entering a horse into a race that it may die and break its neck or legs, or kicking a horse because it's badly behaved. I don't know. I'm about to die on social media by saying this, Anna, but for me, where's the morality in all that? But we seem to be very clear about our intentions, our human intentions to animals, the animals can somehow interpret. If you scare a sheep in a field, you'll probably get arrested. I mean, sheep are programmed to be scared. That's their nature. They face predators in their life. They're programmed to do that. So you approaching them scaring in a field isn't really causing them any major harm. Unless, of course, they're pregnant and they're carrying lambs. Richard's looking at me open mouth. Can't believe what I've just said.
Well, maybe they're frightened because they know you and know what you're going to do to them, Paul. I don't know.
I don't scare sheep. I'm just saying. No. Well, that's jackdaws and ravens, isn't it? They'll actually bring the they'll tell their offspring that guy. They'll hunt you down. Okay, they will do.
They can recognize faces and they live 20, 30 years. Yeah,
I'm just saying we tend to anthropomorphize their reactions to how we behave towards them. Whereas in nature, probably they're programmed to deal with these kind of things anyway. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not justifying animal cruelty. Although I might be. It might seem like I am. I'm sorry if I do seem like I'm justifying. I'm not.
Nor am I. But there is a sort of fine line when you're playing fetch with a dog over tormenting it to death.
Yes, there is. And you're right. You're right. You're frustrating it. I mean, laser light stuff. They get addicted to it, don't they? Yeah. No, dogs too. And they go crazy for it. They become nervous wrecks because of it. Maybe to some extent you're overstimulating them with that ball and it's not good for them. And yet we don't pillory these people playing with their dogs. I mean, I really don't think you should be hugging dogs or keeping them as pets. Give them a separate kennel outside your home. Let them live with other dogs. If you're going to have a dog, keep three or four of them and let them roam wild. I mean,
they should have a job because everyone needs a job to feel a bit of meaning in their life. They could herd a bit of sheep, couldn't they, occasionally? Or
I'm so glad that, the Germans are banning those sausage dogs because... dogs are not made for our enjoyment. You know, they're not made to
not
be bred.
Not made for sausages, are they? Yeah.
They're not made to be bred to please us with their amusing shapes. Fundamentally, they should still be domesticated, but essentially wild animals.
Well, this delightful and amusing conversation about dogs and dog cruelty is going to
get us on the petty list, yeah. Anyway, sorry.
It's
going to get us on somebody's list anyway.
Serious point in this movie, Paul, because when Daniel gets back from his walk... Snoop immediately runs over, and Daniel can't see it, of course, but he follows the dog, and he discovers his father is lying in a pool of blood.
Dead, obviously.
In front of the chalet. In front of the balcony in the attic where he was working.
I mean, it's a big three or four story thing, and those things are high, aren't they? So he's fallen a fair way, but into snow, so would he be dead? Well, potentially he might have banged his head on the shed in front of the chalet, but I guess we're going to dig into this in the court case that's going to follow, yeah?
Of course, Sandra comes out, she phones the police and stuff, and the police come around. Obviously, there's a question of how this happened.
Mm-hmm.
He was working in the attic. The attic window is open. He could potentially have fallen or jumped out.
It was 4'6" in the translation. It was just above waist height. You can't top
difficult
those
to
things.
Fall accidentally, yes. That was the implication.
Mm-hmm. But it's doable.
Yeah, certainly.
If you're straddling yourself, who knows, he might be straddling himself across the window to do some banging, mind it, whatever.
To do some banging, yeah.
They never bring that up in the court case, so I think I would have been a better defence lawyer than anybody who's there.
I think the same thing. But then again, this is the French legal system, which we're going to find is quite different.
Deeply annoying.
To the Anglo-Saxon tradition that we're used to. And that's true, of course, because the Americans are closer to the... They come from the same Anglo-Saxon traditions we did, aren't they? American courtroom dramas, despite the differences, are fundamentally...
Legible, yeah.
Very understandable for us. But this is completely different stuff.
What did you find immediately different? Was the... I don't know, what was different? Well, the fact it's in a beautiful room. With, like, al fresco.
Well, maybe we'll come to it when we get to the court
case. Related art.
Sandra is interviewed by the police and stuff.
Hmm.
She must be aware, apart from anything else, because she's... his spouse, or his ex-spouse, or whatever, that suspicion is going to fall on her. So she quite quickly contacts an old friend of hers, who is
Vincent, barrister.
Oui.
So Sandra's idea is it must have been accidental. He says maybe it was suicide. Doesn't help when the police interview her and they notice bruising on her forearms, her underarm near to her wrists, yeah, which indicates some sort of struggle.
Could be a defensive kind of wound, couldn't it?
She insists that she always bangs her wrists on the kitchen island.
Counter.
Yeah. Doesn't sound very convincing.
Yeah, no, it sounds a little bit like an ad hoc, doesn't it?
She later remembers that he attempted suicide 6 months earlier after coming off his antidepressants.
Yeah, she'd found him lying in his office on his sofa bed or whatever with a pool of vomit with pills in the vomit, which turned out to be aspirin or something. During the interview that she has with Vincent about the case, she says that she felt her husband was playing that song so loudly to piss her off and make the journalist leave, or the student leave.
So it's obvious there's some sort of tension in the marital relationship, isn't there?
And she's not being totally honest, is she?
No.
Her story is that Samuel came down, spoke to her, and then went back upstairs to the attic to continue working.
And she decided to do a bit of work and then had a nap with her earplugs in.
She'd gone to her bed where she sits and works with a laptop. And the music's on repeat all through this, I think. She didn't claim that he'd switched it off.
She did say she put some earplugs in, but then he said, well, how did you wake up? She said, well, one of them must have fallen out. And then
fallen
I heard
out,
screams.
Yeah.
So very unconvincing, isn't it, the whole account?
Yeah. And also, Sandra claimed that he was a very cautious man and that he did not normally drink during the day. Obviously, son Daniel is very distraught by the whole thing. There's a point where Monica, who is his godmother, comes around, tries to comfort him, and she starts to suggest a psychic. And I thought, oh God, here we go. This is where this movie's going. Fortunately, it didn't come up because no one took that suggestion seriously, which is good. I just wanted to make this point, how dangerous a psychic would be. Monica's argument was that it might give him some comfort to speak to this psychic lady. But how would have it helped the son come to terms with his father's death by hearing something made up by someone who doesn't know anything? Even if you want to believe that there are psychics in the world, which obviously there are, even if you think there's any plausible mechanism by which someone's personality could survive the death of their brain, which everything we know about the brain and about living tells us that's just not true. You don't even survive the night, do you? Even if there were real psychics, though, how would you tell a good psychic from a fraudulent one? Like, what test would you perform to know that you're about to get one of the ones who's actually...
You're asking a very pertinent question, and the same could be asked of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts.
Oh, wow, Paul, have you joined the Scientologists?
What do you mean?
They have a thing about psychiatrists and psychoanalysts.
I have a thing about psychoanalysts, yeah.
Oh, okay. Hail Xenu.
No, I mean, I don't know what they're saying about it, but I mean, on what basis do we believe what they say? Because one of them, I mean, annoyingly, one of them has brought Samuel's psychoanalyst, he's brought forward, or psychiatrist, I'm not quite sure which one, he's brought forward as a witness later on, okay? And it's not so much what he says about what Samuel says during his sessions, which might be pertinent. It's rather his insight into Sandra's motivations.
Huh.
I just find it deeply annoying. Nobody else would say that in a court case, would they? They wouldn't be allowed to speculate and pontificate about an accused's motives. But this all passes without any kind of complaint, really, from the defence or any overruling from the judge. So
Vincent draws a diagram of what could have happened, which shows someone falling out the attic window, hitting the shed at the bottom, and then landing next to the shed and sliding or crawling a little bit.
Because the police have noticed the splatter of blood is consistent with somebody having been struck three floors up, and then the blood spraying down. Does that make sense?
That's the police's notion,
yes, yeah.
Vincent says, though, that the problem with that is there's no DNA on the top of the shed roof where the impact must have happened. But there is this spray, as you say, on the side of the shed, which police are arguing came from above.
Later on, this is all before the trial starts, there's some idea of melting snow that kind of means that there wouldn't be a DNA trace up there.
It's actually during the trial we see that.
Oh, is it? Okay. It's just there's quite a lot of pre-trial stuff where the police team are dropping bodies off the roof and then the defence team are dropping bodies off the roof, and we never really see the results of it, but we just see them doing that, okay.
The police are depicted, I think, as pretty bad at their interviews. They make very leading questions, particularly of the young boy, Daniel.
Do you think every character in this movie is designed to provoke and annoy, or what?
Possibly so, yes.
I mean, the prosecution are just so freaking annoying.
Annoying. They are very annoying.
The psychiatrist, or the psychologist they bring as a witness, just so freaking annoying. Vincent, the defence lawyer, is, I think, intended to be viewed in a very positive light, isn't it?
I think we're kind of looking at the case through his eyes. Because, of course, we don't know what happened as the audience. You know, unlike the way a lot of movies of this kind might be shot, we don't see the events. We only see kind of what the key witnesses...
You know, I was waiting for a big kind of gasp revelation moment, like Daniel the kid did it, or Snoop the dog did it, but nothing really ever happened like that. It was always, obviously... No,
you're quite right. The shadow of suspicion did lie heavy over Snoop. For a considerable part of this movie, didn't it? Yes. Vincent is warning Sandra that an accidental fall is going to be very difficult to prove. And he's talking about a possible suicide as a better explanation. Sandra is saying, I don't think he committed suicide, I think he fell. But Vincent's point is, it doesn't matter what you think, it doesn't matter what the truth is, it matters what we can sell to the court, what the public perception will be. That is going to win or lose this case.
I think this is a problem that lay people often have with lawyering and court. Is it's not about the truth, is it, at all?
No.
And that's why people often settle out of court, because they know there's a chance, even though they might not have done something, there's a chance they could be found guilty. It's about the preponderance of evidence, isn't it? Not about the actual truth of the matter. So they're two distinct things. Obviously, there's a connection. Tangential connection between them. So he makes a very good point. But it would have been nice if this movie was about that, about the nature of truth, the probabilistic nature of interpretation and that kind of stuff. But it's not really, is it, in the end?
There's a thing about Daniel's testimony, because he is keen to say that his parents weren't arguing when he left to take the dog. He says they were talking at a normal volume. But the police are incredulous. They say, well, the music was still on, it was really loud. How could you have heard them if they weren't raising their voices? And so they wind up in the end taking Daniel outside with the music on, like the volume it was on, and getting them to reenact a conversation
at various volumes. Yeah, that's right.
Eventually, Daniel changes his testimony and says he must have been inside when he heard the talking. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not what he said. It also doesn't quite align with the timelines of when he left and stuff. I think he says he went back in and heard it.
He says he knows where he was because he felt some felt on a roof or something.
He says his dad puts duct tape in different places so that he knows where he is, which is very clever.
He later retracts that, doesn't he?
It was at this point in the movie that I realised Daniel was blind.
Right.
It also transpires, just before the court starts, I think, that there's some kind of recording that the police have, which transpires to be a USB audio recording that Sam had made. Apparently he was in the habit of recording conversations as study material for his novel writing. And one of these had turned out to be an argument maybe a couple of days before his death. So they indict Sandra with this evidence that the police think they're building up. They go to court where they're claiming a heavy blunt force blow to the head had been used to knock him over the balcony when they'd been arguing, and that she'd obviously hit him with something. Mm. We'd also, by the way, quite early on as well, we'd seen an autopsy, hadn't we? Where they'd looked at Samuel's body and determined. They said that there was a blow to his head.
With a blunt instrument, yeah.
It wasn't consistent with the position he was found in on the ground, implying that it had occurred before he hit the ground where he was found.
Sure.
And there was another mark somewhere, but it wasn't really significant. Yeah, so the court proceeds, and this is where you start to see how different stuff is in a French court. Apart from anything else, they keep referring to the jurors. They referred several times to the jurors, but there wasn't, I don't think there was a jury, right? Was there a jury box of 12?
No. No.
I think jurors are the panel of judges that are sitting. I was reading up about the differences between the French and the English legal system. The French is all post-Napoleonic, based on Roman and civic law. So there's not much emphasis placed in French law on case law and case history. In the UK and in the US...
That's common law, isn't it? Yeah.
Common law, exactly. And our long history of judgments, each judgment sets up a precedent for future trials. And so good lawyers are all about going back, finding similar cases, and using those precedents to make the judge rule in the same way as the last time.
It's like a shimmering, interconnected spider's nest, isn't it, really?
Yes.
If he hits it, they all scurry out in different directions.
There's much less emphasis on that in French law. It's all about interpreting the law as written. Which
statute
is
law, yeah. So it's a statute system, yeah.
It's also described as an inquisitorial system in that the judge has herself in this case, or himself, participates in questioning the witnesses and so on. Whereas I think in an English court, it would only be prosecution lawyers and the defence lawyers who were allowed to cross-examine. The other crazy thing that keeps happening in this court case is during a witness testimony, they'll just ask Sandra to stand up and weigh in on what the witness is saying.
What's that, a licence, artistic licence? Does that really happen in French courts? It must be.
Fascinating, isn't it? It's all fascinating. It's very different. By the way, we should say, Sandra is not French, in fact. No. She's German. It becomes a point of contention later, doesn't it? But sort of asks her husband to speak English in their household, and Daniel to speak English in their household, as a sort of lingua franca, ironically. So a good part of this film is, in fact, spoken in English. Mm-hmm. But there are scenes, and a lot of the court scenes, because initially they start in the courts doing it in French only, don't they? Although Sandra asks to speak in English after a while.
So if you were watching this movie with more care than I was, you'd be waiting to hear the tape of the discovered recording in the court case. And I'd forgotten this existed. So it was like, oh, right, okay, that's what we're waiting for, when it actually turned up about an hour and a quarter or an hour and a half into the movie.
Well, they do drag it out, don't they? Mm-hmm. So the court case goes through lots of different areas. And as you say, the prosecution guys of right knobhead picks up lots of quite annoying points all the time. They get various expert witnesses, as you say, including the sort of psychiatrist or whatever that is assisting. And then they get two blood splatter experts, one for the prosecution and one for the defence. Mm-hmm. The prosecution one just argues that these three marks must have come from high up because they're really long. I think blood splatter is one of those areas of criminal forensics that is mostly bullshit and not very much science, because there isn't really a science of blood splatter. The way you become an expert is a bit like you just look at a load of blood splatter scenes. And I suppose you might go into a laboratory with some fake blood and start splashing it around in some ways and taking pictures. But it's all kind of subjective, isn't it?
What about bulleted projectile analysis?
What bit of that are you talking about?
Is that similarly hokum or not?
Entrance
wounds and exit wounds and that kind of thing.
I have to look into it, but there is a crisis in forensic science, because there are a lot of these fields that are presented in the courtroom as science to back up one side or the other's point. Uh-huh. That it transpires, there's just no repeatable or good science behind it. A great example is...
Well, Richard, biography, if the Scientologists don't object to it, it must be true. Yeah?
Hey, I'm not the one with a problem with psychiatrists.
Exactly, but you Do you say psychiatry is okay, but blood splatter is not okay?
I'm saying it's potentially suspect, yes, Paul.
But psychiatry isn't.
Listen, I'm agnostic about psychiatry. Right. A great example is bite mark analysis. Uh-huh. So police have got bite marks quite often on a victim, be they dead or alive. What they'll sometimes do is get people to bite a styrofoam cup, and then they'll compare bite marks, or they'll send those to a bite mark analysis expert. But there's no real science about how people's teeth leave marks in flesh and how flesh responds to teeth marks and whether...
Well, unless you test a lot of flesh with teeth marks, I guess. But...
Exactly. And the only real way of doing that accurately...
is to gnaw down on people.
Yeah. So there's a great deal of studies and post-conviction legal work that has been overturning with more reliable stuff like DNA evidence. Although DNA evidence, of course, has been misused in the past.
DNA evidence can be easily planted, can't it? That's the main problem with it.
It can be planted, it can be misplanted, transplanted accidentally, like the famous Phantom of Hellebron, which we may have talked about before. Mm-hmm. That was where a worker in a sort of swab factory or something got her DNA contaminating test kits, and that made police start looking for a serial killer that was implicated in many different murders all over the
And if the criminals country. Can purloin items of clothing that they know are contaminated with other people's DNA and use them as outer garments in a crime scene, can't they?
And the better we get at amplifying small DNA samples, that means that tiny exchanges of DNA that might be incidental,
probably are incidental,
second or third hand, might implicate someone unfairly. But even more weirdly,
I'm going to stop Richard getting onto lie detector tests because I feel he's heading in that direction. But
one way that DNA was misused in the early days, I think it's less prevalent now. Because the earlier days of DNA, you look for certain sequences as fingerprint kind of style things. And I think when it started, there probably weren't that many sequences they were looking for, which reduced the number of degrees of freedom. So... matches or false positives were more likely. I think that's true in the earliest days. Even so, they had enough different fingerprints that if you chose someone at random, indeed it was thousands to one that you'd get a match or a close match. But of course, people quite often not chosen at random. Imagine the police have got a description of a person, and I say Caucasian, dark hair, tall, short, male, female. Those are all, of course, encoded in the genetics.
Of course, yeah.
When they go and find a subject, test the genes. If you're not testing sensitively enough, you may well find that a lot more people would match than you would expect. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the point. I think blood splatter is one of those areas. The defense blood splatter is really interesting because she explains the stuff about the...
Sorry, can I just interrupt there? I mean, one of the classic prosecutor's fallacies is 99% of people read pornography. This man reads pornography, therefore he's 99% certain to have committed the crime. In fact, the more people share that attribute, the less likely it is that one person's going to have that attribute. Isn't it? But it passes unchallenged in so many court cases, that kind of fallacious argument.
Because A implies B does not mean B implies A. So the defence's blood splatter witness blows a hole in the whole blood splatter argument. Although I'm dubious about the science, I was cheering her on for doing that.
And also, Vincent does a good job taking down the psychiatrist, or the psychoanalyst, I think it is. He says, you're suddenly an expert on suicide. How many of your patients commit suicide? And he says, well, none. He says, well, then what do you know about this man's state of mind?
Well, he actually gets told off, doesn't he? I think he sort of makes a speech at that point. Or he might do it a bit later when he's talking about suicide. But he presents a theory about suicide. Uh-huh. Again, it seemed like the kind of thing you wouldn't be allowed to do in an
English
court.
Not allowed at all, no.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called in English court. Is it called conflation and speculation?
Conjecture, yeah.
Conjecture, that's right.
We reach the point where they're talking about the relationship, whether or not Sandra had reason to kill him. And the prosecutor is spinning this argument that because Sandra is bisexual and because she seemed to be flirting with the journalist, that Samuel would get jealous and mad with her. That's why he turned the music up. Presumably, they're trying to claim that that made Sandra mad, so she hit him with the
murder object.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strange all this, wasn't it? It's all very, very strange. I mean, the idea that offering somebody a drink in your home is flirting with them is is just weird, isn't it? But then I thought, what I thought this movie did quite well was present Sandra facing essentially patriarchal objectification and oppression. I mean, when we finally get to hear the argument, I don't want to describe it just for the moment, but it's pretty obvious that what the prosecution say about it means that they kind of feel that the jury would assume that a man has a right to take control of his life and his wife, kind of thing. I thought it was quite interesting how that was presented, really. I think it's a moment, the argument, but we just hear the audio, don't we? Although I think we get like some sort of replay of some of the visuals. I think it's her moment as an actor to shine, really. And
yeah,
across as a vulnerable, powerful female.
I think you're absolutely right. It's a very... It is taking a view on the patriarchy of the court system here. You know, the director is Justine Triet, I believe. Yeah, it's certainly written with that perspective in mind. I read something that pointed out that all of the prosecution witnesses and experts were men, the psychiatrist and one of the blood-to-blood experts, and all the ones that were sympathetic toward Sandra were women. It's interesting. But yeah, you're absolutely right. She was like on trial for witchcraft, really, wasn't she?
Yes.
They're judging her for her bisexuality and for her the way she was handling her life and in control of her own life. They're making out that was such a kind of an emasculating imposition on Samuel.
I think she said it really well here because it really triggered me. It's like, oh my gosh, Samuel, you lose all sympathy for him when you hear him argue. The things he says, he's needling, kind of blaming
for
his own problems. And it almost turns into her soliloquy at the end, just before the real kind of, before the violence of the argument. And it turns into her soliloquy where she says, I'm not to blame for any of this, and you've got your own life to lead, and I didn't force you to come here and buy a house and that kind of thing. She makes perfectly valid and reasonable points about she doesn't see him as the victim that he feels he is, and he needs to pull his finger out and get a grip.
Well, that's the thrust of this recorded conversation that is replayed in court, and is one of the only two scenes we see depicted in flashback, just with the audio that's been recorded. Because I think Justin didn't want, again, she didn't want to give us any insight that we shouldn't have about the case, to leave us every bit in as much in doubt as the rest of the court is. That we're allowed to kind of envisage what's happening in this conversation. Which ends apparently with a bit of violence that Sandra says was her throwing a wine glass and then slapping him and then him hitting himself in anguish and anger and hitting the wall and putting a hole in it and stuff.
Of which there are photos demonstrating the fact the wall has been damaged. So yeah, it seems to be that the defence arguments are kind of winning out towards the end, aren't they? At least it's not watertight what the prosecution is saying. There's another thing the prosecution says that's deeply annoying and triggering, which is they then pull out one of her books and pick one of the minor characters. The minor character, who isn't a mirror of her, talks about getting rid of her husband and murdering her husband.
I think this mirrors real cases, doesn't it? Where an author has like written down the method of killing someone, and then
if they're crime authors in particular, that kind of, they're good. I mean, there's going to be at least one character
bound to be
in their novels that mirrors any kind of thing that might happen to their spouse in a criminal situation. So yeah, kind of a very existential danger of being an author, isn't it? Really, make sure nothing happens to your spouse, kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, that's very true. Now, just as the case is about to wrap up, the judge makes a surprise announcement that Daniel wants to come back and make another statement.
Oh, wow, the whole thing's going to turn on a sixpence. Who could see this coming?
Another difference here, again, with the legal system is I think there's strict laws or rules about admitting evidence into a court case in the English legal system. I'm not saying you can't introduce evidence late, but I think you have to share it with both sides of the... Certainly the prosecution has to share it with the defence, don't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
French courts seem to be a bit more freewheeling. It's like, yeah, oh yeah, sure. Come in, make a speech. Let's hear it. Let's hear your opinion.
Well, it's like their cars. This vehicle of justice has a few dings on the outside. It's just appearance, isn't it? It doesn't really affect how the little 2CV goes.
Over the weekend, Daniel's gone home. On Monday, he's going to go back into court. We see him pulling and using the braille on them, pulling out boxes of aspirin from under the kitchen sink. Then he goes and feeds Snoop. He goes to bed.
Now, I was ready for the cliffhanger that Daniel had poisoned his dad, but this is not the case, is it?
No, but he does poison Snoop because Snoop is real sick in the morning. Oh. And he admits to his court-appointed protector, Marge. Really cool, actually. I quite like Marge. She seems to know exactly what to do. She goes and feeds the dog salt water to get it to chuck up.
Mm-hmm.
Which it does. Again, amazing acting from Snoop.
It was really good acting from Snoop.
Yeah, acting sick on command and convincingly woozy afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he won an award, so there we go.
Anyway, Snoop is safe for the quick actions of Marge. But, I mean, Daniel now reveals the big thing, doesn't he? Is that why was he doing this to Snoop? Well, he was replaying what happened that night when his dad was supposed to try to commit suicide.
That's right. So Sandra's claim that he'd taken some pills and then sicked them up. Daniel had noticed that Snoop had got sick in the same way, and he now realises it must have been that Snoop had eaten his dad's vomit.
As they do, dogs will do that. They'll lick it up.
Disgusting. You say they're intelligent, Paul.
I don't know why I was forced in that position. I don't know. You've got me on the side of Scientologists and Crufts. I don't know how that happened. Look, so, but then also, there was the killer blow, which is when his father was guiltily taking Snoop, who had almost died off his dad's sick, to the vets. He kind of had a tete-a-tete with Daniel saying, look, the people you love can disappear at any time. You better get used to it because it's going to happen. Sooner or later, kind of.
He was saying, Snoop looks after you in every way. He's always looking out for you. He's going to get tired eventually, and then that'll just be his time to go. Mm. And Daniel says he now realises his dad was really talking about himself, not about Snoop. Or probably about both of them, to be fair. It's an important moment in the case. The prosecutor's a bit pissed off and says, this doesn't matter anyway, it's just, you can't even remember when it happened, kind of thing. Perhaps, understandably, Sandra is acquitted, and she goes with a lawyers to the Chinese and stuff.
And doesn't get off with Vincent, although you think you should do.
I read an interview about that where I think the actress said that that would have been a very 80s thing to do. That would have happened in an 80s movie. But she's quite right. And she said it's stupid that in order to show that two people have affection for one another, you have to show them shagging. I don't think she used those words.
But were they supposed to be all flames or not? Because doesn't he admit
it was alluded to, yeah. At least they knew each other, were close, perhaps.
But halfway through the movie, don't they get drunk together and they're out in the cold drinking on the snow and she says, what do you remember when you first met me? And he says, I was terribly in love with you, that kind of thing. So I thought it might be the case that they get together. However, she's just terribly upset, isn't she, after it? She's just deeply traumatised by the whole process. And obviously...
Well, Vincent's too decent to do that, isn't he? Anyway.
And he's decent, yeah. He's a great guy, generally. So before we discuss this movie and what we thought of it, what would you have found if you were the juror? Would you have found her guilty or not guilty, Richard?
Not guilty. And to my mind...
It's obvious, isn't it? She's not guilty.
I think it's obvious, yeah. I think it's obvious. I thought it was obvious pretty much from the autopsy. And I'll tell you my reasoning. And this would be my pitch if I was a defence lawyer. The autopsy found one injury on his head.
Mm.
We know that he fell from the second or third floor, and that must have caused an injury. You couldn't fall in that way.
Yes, you're right, aren't you?
And so unless the prosecution are arguing that he was hit on the head and then fell on exactly the same place, then the blow on his head must have been caused by the fall, and that therefore means he must have hit the shed.
Richard, you miss your métier here, haven't you? You should be the Old Bailey here.
Well, I thought it was a lot simpler than they were making out.
And beyond that, I think what is great about this movie is the audio and the argument. It's such a well acted argument, just brilliant. Yeah. You know, the way the frustration just builds on both sides, the attempts to communicate, particularly on her side, the wife's side, to no avail. It's just a marital argument, isn't it? Just brilliantly conveyed. But
and
I think
it builds so gradually. They start actually having a conversation, a serious conversation, but they're not snapping at each other initially. And she is quite pleasant.
Well, I think it's obvious in that argument that he is highly abusive and manipulative and quite nasty, actually, isn't he? Blaming her for stuff that's got nothing to do with her. And so for me...
And she has a lot of coping strategies.
She does.
Which I think is a very female experience, right? Is in an abusive relationship that you've built up these strategies that you use to avoid to defuse, to de-escalate.
Exactly, and she deals with exasperation several times in that argument. And so it would be very psychologically out of character for her to suddenly walk up the stairs and attack him from behind him and deliver a blunt blow to the head kind of thing. It doesn't make any sense, does it? So yeah, I would have acquitted her.
I think the presence of that USB recording, which I think the prosecution presumably thought helped their case,
does the opposite.
It really motivates Samuel's suicide, doesn't it? Mm. Which I think we have to conclude. She was acquitted, she didn't kill him. They don't actually say whether he fell or killed himself, but I think we're led to the obvious conclusion that he'd been contemplating this and didn't kill himself, so... Interesting, yeah. It had me shouting at the screen on occasion, especially at the prosecution.
Yeah, well played by the director. The prosecution was really, really annoying.
Odious, yes.
Yeah. So it is set up beautifully like that. In the end, you have to root for it, don't you? Even if, at the beginning, you were very much on the prosecutor's side. I like the way she kind of enfolds this so that she turns it round and you have to come back out onto Sandra's side. Yeah.
So I'm expecting a big score for acting from you, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the lead, brilliant acting by somebody famous. She's a famous German actress, isn't she? Sandra Hüller. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. But also the child actor, Milo Machado Grané, I thought was relatively well portrayed. And of course, Vincent as the lovable, nice lawyer that everyone's on the defense team. Great too. But I think as a lead, she did very, very well here. I don't know how to express how well she did, but I'm just going to score a 9, Richard, for acting.
Oh, you've already forgotten the dog as well. Nessie the dog.
Yeah, props to the dog. Well done. I've never seen a dog loll and droozle, if that's the word, so effectively after an overdose, as old Snoop did.
So you're going to give him a good boy, are you?
Yeah, I'm going to give him a good boy sticker and he can stick his tongue out and lick up the water from the bowl.
Yeah, I think a 9 is fair for this. Yeah, I'll stipulate to that, as they would say in court. So, what do we do for another, I guess, plot, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't structured in the kind of symmetry of typical courtroom dramas where we're going to have a nice twist, that kind of thing. It was just real, wasn't it? And I appreciated that. It was
documentary-esque, yes.
And yeah. I like that kind of real feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
it's on the ground, though, wasn't it, at times?
Oh, certainly it's slow, yeah. And because I did feel that the case was simpler than they were making out, yeah. I got to mark it down for that. Mm-hmm. But they achieve their aim of trying to maintain ambiguity for quite a long time, don't they? And the way they feed information out about their past, I suppose, is quite similar to how you would encounter that with a real case where you start to learn more about the accused. So that's all. Yeah, it's all quite realistic, isn't it? But to give it a score...
Yeah, how are you going to score it?
It's tricky, but I think I'll go 7.
Plus. That's just what I've written down here. I get a 7.2.
Okay. Well, we're in agreement. It's not crazy. Okay.
I don't know what else to score it on, I have to be honest with you.
Yeah. It's not an action, is it? There's no action, really.
No. Was there any suspense? Was there any suspense there? Not really. Would you score it on a lack of typical expectations you have for a courtroom drama? Like suspense, surprise?
Subverting the genre, in a way. Mm. I mean, it avoids a lot of the usual nonsense tropes of Hollywood.
It does. It's quite fresh, isn't it?
Where the lawyer throws something at the guy and he catches it left-handed. Or yeah. That kind of stuff.
So how about freshness? Courtroom freshness?
It's snow fresh, isn't it? It's like the snow melting off the valley sides. It's interesting, very interesting. I'll give it an 8 for fresh.
Ah, so it spritzed your room perfumery. Okay. Yeah, I thought it was very fresh. Yeah, I thought it was egg-laid fresh. So I'm going to score it 8 for that reason.
And then overall, for this Palme d'Or winning...
Yeah, it's not all that. It's still a good watch. I'd score it 8 in total.
Yeah, that's a fair score. Yeah, I mean, I see no reason to deviate from your scoring policy, Paul.
Okay.
Boringly so.
Welcome to... Right. Welcome to Scientology, Richard. Right, okay.
Clever agreement.
8 it is. A definite recommend from me. Just a little bit slow on the ground. I was itching to fast forward. Is it a quiet bit? There were no quiet bits. It's full of talk. So there's nothing you can kind of fast forward through. You've got to sit through 2.5 hours of it. So if you've got time, if you've got a whole evening, it's a definite recommend.
It's entertaining. Now, Paul, this week, Alex Garland's Civil War raging across cinemas.
Yeah.
And we've got to see that. But whether we can see it in time to record for the podcast, I mean, probably we can. But I think we need to have a backup for Alex Garland's Civil War.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I throw three.
Okay, you're going to throw three at me. Okay.
I am going to throw three things at you, Rich. The first is Oculus.
Oculus. I think it's a Mike Flanagan horror film.
The second and the third are by the director of Dogtooth, which we've recently watched and reviewed, Poor Things, and Lobster.
Lanthimos, right? Yorgos Lanthimos?
Yes, is Greek. This? I know that much.
Poor Things, which is advertised on Prime or something at the moment, and Lobster, which I think is a bit older.
But was a hit, I think, Lobster.
I would, of those three, choose Oculus.
Right. First choice is Civil War, Alex Garland's new thing. Failing that, it's going to be Oculus.
I think we watch Oculus anyway.
Yeah, let's do that.
And we record it next, no matter what, after if we manage to see Civil War.
Okay, dog.
Who are you rooting for, Paul? Are you rooting for the MAGA or the Libs?
Hey, it's that season, and it's the same season here on the UK side, isn't it? On this side of the Atlantic. We're going to get an election at the end of this year, aren't we, pretty much?
Oh, we don't know. They haven't told us, have they?
They don't know what they're doing, do they? Let's face facts. So.
They're going to hold on, presumably, for as long as they dare.
The idea, like, if they go now, they'll still keep 50 seats. Whereas if they hold on... Are we looking at a potential wipeout here? I don't know.
I mean, that's what people say, but...
It never turns out that way, does it?
I don't think it can turn out that way.
People say they're going to vote Reform, and then suddenly they turn Tory again, don't they? That kind of thing. 5 days before the election.
At the time of recording, tomorrow, Trump's first criminal trial begins. That means he has to be there sitting in the dock, as I understand.
Whoa.
That. Yeah,
that's funny. That's all media fodder for him, isn't it? That's all great stuff for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Cast him as the outcast. Cast him as the victim. He's got to be loving it, Richard, you know what I mean? I think the terrifying thing is, when was it? 8 years ago when he came into power? Like, in the run-up to the election, I was working with lots of Americans. And they were like, he's never going to get in. Because they were all Democrats with T. And I was like, no, I think he will get in. He's an effective communicator, what I said. And they said, no, he just repeats himself all the time. I said, well, yeah. I mean, I think he's only half conscious. I don't think he does it knowingly. However, for his audience, what he does is he communicates very effectively, doesn't he? Or at least it's received very well. And he got in. They were all crying in the bar that night when he got in. So they knew more than me because I just thought it was funny. The guy with the shark attack was now running the country. It's kind of like what was it? What's that movie called? Idiocracy.
Idiocracy. Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah.
This guy with no pretensions really to being a serious politician is suddenly controlling the country. But yeah, so it could happen again, unless of course he loses these criminal cases, in which case he ain't getting to the White House, is he?
I don't know what will happen.
But well, I think it's that really thing interesting if there's some delay in if he can hold out the court case, let it proceed beyond election. If he gets elected, then he can dismiss his own case, can't he?
Some of them, yeah. The federal cases, but not the state case.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Rich has been looking into this.
Tomorrow's case is really all about whether it was okay for him to have fucked a prostitute whilst his wife was pregnant and then paid her hush money during the run-up to an election in an attempt to conceal his misdeeds from the electorate. If you think that's okay, then he gets away with it. But if you think that's election interference, then he's a criminal and he may go to jail.
Oh. That's actually quite tough, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to be partisan on this, but that's a toughie.
We'll see. We'll see. Jury selection begins tomorrow, I think, so that's going to be interesting. Enough politics and enough drive-by cinema.
Yes.
Until the next time.
Episode 37.
When we'll have watched...
No, 38.
Civil War or Oculus, or both of them.
Or neither.
Thank you for listening.
Ciao for now.
Goodbye.
See you on the next one. Bye.
Thank you.
2.